race is on, and Lewis Hamilton has gone from record sharer to record setter with his 92nd Formula One victory in the Portuguese Grand Prix. And what a win it was, after a chaotic first few laps and with a big winning margin after overtaking teammate Valtteri Bottas to get the lead back. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to review a remarkable race are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Mark, go to you first. What did you make of F1's visit to the Algarve circuit? It's a rather nice venue, isn't it?
Great venue, yeah, lovely venue. It turned out to be a really fascinating event, actually, because of the pandemic. If you think about it, we're at a circuit we're never going to be at a time of year where the weather's a lot cooler than the tires were ever expecting to see, and the track surface was late notice resurfaced, and that played a massive part in the pattern of the weekend. So all the good things about this weekend, about this event, were as a result of the shaking up of the variables from the pandemic. So not everything's bad.
There we go. There's a positive story. But because I'm the one who's actually here this weekend, I've had to put up with the weird traffic routing that was going on, which meant it took three times as long to get back to my hotel from the circuit. But I'll let them off that, particularly seeing as they've put this race together at short notice. Scott Mitchell, as ever, watching on from Stockholm. How was your view from there? Was your telescope able to give you a good view, or did you have to rely on the television?
Come on, leave it out. Leave it out, Ed. Let's not go down that road again. All right, I've made a fool of myself enough times. No, my view from Stockholm was as good as always. Lots of different camera angles, lots of onboards, lots to look out for. I got lost very much in the opening two laps. It was just very difficult to keep track of everywhere you had to have your eyes darting all over the place. But it was brilliant. I was really, really looking forward to this event. Not necessarily the race, because I didn't have high expectations for Algarve as a spectacle, but I was super excited because I'd spoken to the likes of George Russell, Felix Rosenqvist, Julian Palmer, people who have raced at Algarve before. And I was just super excited to see what F1 cars would look like at this track. To me, this was like Mugello on steroids in terms of excitement, just because of the undulation and the nature of the circuit. So I was super excited, and I really think that the Grand Prix lived up to my expectations.
Yeah, I was very pleased that there's been a Grand Prix here. I first went here for F1 testing 11 years ago. It hailed at one stage, but otherwise it was just great to watch cars going around here, and thought that the time had passed, the opportunity had gone for there to be a Grand Prix here. But actually, while we're on the subject of your telescope, I think I can comment on what's in the background in your living room while you're talking, because Max Verstappen did the same in a press conference.
Yeah, that was massively unexpected on Thursday. Obviously, we know that Max is an avid sim racer. So at some point over the last, 4 months or so, 3 or 4 months, he clocked that the majority of the times I appeared on the Zoom calls for media sessions, my play seat challenge was parked in the background. But a couple of my sim racing seasons have recently ended, and I've basically lost the battle to keep it out in the living room for no reason for 10 days. So I had to put it into storage. So when we did the FIA pressers on Thursday, it was no longer visible in my background, which I didn't think anyone would notice. But Max clocked it and asked me where it had gone and why I'd stopped, which I thought was simultaneously brilliantly attentive and also an indicator of how bored he is during those media sessions.
You evidently thought you'd retired. I can't see much in the background in Mark's room. Is that a guitar case in the background? Or
that's a guitar case, yeah. There's a guitar to the side and a bed.
You're in a guitar pincer movement by the sounds of it. Some kind of surreal nightmare.
These visual prompts work really well on a podcast. The listeners are going to be absolutely delighted.
I'm just disappointed that no one's asking me about the jovial wallpaper and the air conditioning unit you can see in the background.
You look like you're in a stereotypical depiction of like an American sweet shop from the 60s or the 50s.
I don't really know how to respond to that. I see where you may have got that impression from. It's a nice little, they call it a studio apartment. It's basically a bedroom with a little kitchen attached. So, very exciting.
Well, it's Sunday night. We're doing a podcast and Ed is quite literally a kid in the candy store.
So. There we go. In that case, I'd have some eating to do probably. But so anyway, let's get on with it. So, Mark, if we dive straight into the race, Lewis Hamilton did hold the lead at the start. So there was that brief moment of business as usual. proved to be a madcap first few laps, three different leaders. We knew it was going to be tricky to get the tyres working, particularly for those on mediums, but it created even more drama than anyone expected.
Yeah, and it was the mix of mediums and softs that created that, because the softs, all the tyres were difficult to get up to temperature, but the softs, at least it was possible to do it. Not everyone did, but quite a few of them did. The mediums, you just couldn't. The mediums wouldn't come up to temperature on just one formation lap. They needed about four laps. So you suddenly had this situation where the quick guys at the front, the two Mercs and Verstappen on the mediums, were about, you know, among the slowest cars on the circuit for a few corners anyway. And so you had this madcap thing where the soft guys came storming through, Carlos Sainz led. And then, of course, as quick as the soft tyres had warmed up, they then grained. And just as they were graining, the mediums were coming up to temperature. So then all the medium guys came flying back past again. And that's great. Just this great, exciting first lap. It saw Kimi Räikkönen up to sixth place on his softs from 16th. Did some fantastic moves. He was it was like going back a few years and seeing the Kimi of old. But it was all a bit of a mirage, really. It was just the massive grip offset between the two tyre compounds and the very different ways that they came in and behaved in these unusually cold and damp conditions.
Yeah, it was a funny first few laps, wasn't it? Because we saw Bottas was looking quite feisty initially. He battled his way past Max Verstappen, and then he passed Hamilton. And you thought, oh, we don't normally see this Bottas on the first lap. And then Carlos Sainz went past him. So it kind of spoiled the illusion there for Valtteri as well, didn't it?
Yeah, a little, yeah. Yeah, so, it had the effect of making some guys look way better than other guys. And it's easy to put that down to differing skill levels, but actually it's inevitably driven by hugely variable grip of tyres that are at wildly different temperatures. And the puzzle then becomes not about how quickly you can drive, but about how you unlock the code of that puzzle and how you work out how to get the heat into the tyres and keep it there. And ultimately, that's what won Lewis the race over Valtteri.
Have you both seen the onboard footage of Kimi's first lap or the first lap and a half? I had so much fun putting a piece together on the website for that, and had some input from Alex Albon and Daniel Ricciardo as well. And I think like Max Verstappen talked about it in the press conference. It was really interesting, because what you were saying there, Mark, about how it's there's such a big offset in performance. And, Albon, who went backwards during that stint, he said, it was like Kimi was on a different track to everybody else. And Kimi said that he was halfway around the lap thinking, what are the others doing? Because he was thinking, this is completely normal. I'm not doing anything special. All I'm doing is just driving. But it was so funny, because when he gets... If anyone listening hasn't seen it, you can find it probably anywhere on Twitter with an easy search. If you go onto the race website, we've got a piece on there, and there's an F1 tweet embedded within that article, so you'll be able to see the video. And it's just brilliant, because once he sort of steadies it in like seventh or eighth place and he's going into the final third of the lap, he comes across the lead group when they're just like tripping over each other. It's one of the most remarkable opening laps I've seen in ages.
It's fantastic, because at each corner, the quality of the opposition was visibly going up. He's like, he starts off battling with Williamses, and then he's sort of next couple of corners, he's there with a racing point. And then, before too long, he's up with Max Verstappen and trying to get past. And it's just the quality of the opposition is increasing at every corner. It's amazing.
But the resistance is going down at the same time.
Yeah.
It's quite fun, because this is one of those circuits where you can actually see the track from the media centre. Obviously, we're very restricted on where we can go. But I could look out the window for the run to turn five, the sort of downhill hairpin that then you go up out of it, which is where Sainz passed Bottas. And on that first lap, all you could just see was people locking up because they hadn't got the tyres going. It was, you could see how tough the conditions were. But it's great when you get a little bit of a shake-up at the start, because it does shuffle the pack, because some people got the tyres working quicker than others. So instantly you create better racing, because you've moved the order around a little bit, which is what's important, I think, the early stages of races often just everyone settles down into order and then you don't see much happening. Scott, let's get on to the kind of substance of the race. It took Hamilton until the 20th lap to get the lead from Bottas, but he went on to win by just over 25 seconds, which is an almost unheard of margin in F1 today. And of course, he had to pass Sainz before he could get to Bottas. So how did he do it? How do you explain this difference? Because Bottas in the press conference did say he was just quicker than me today.
I think if I had a clear answer to that, I'd probably be making an absolute fortune selling it to all of the teams so they could work out what it is that Lewis is doing. It's difficult to put it down to anything. I think we saw earlier in the weekend that Bottas had got to grips with this track really well. His status as the Friday world champion, FP1 world champion, the green track world champion, whatever you, Ed, decide to call that particular fictional contest on any given week. It really helps. He's been really good. We saw it at Mugello, Nürburgring, and now here, that he gets into this groove quite quickly. And Lewis was sort of always playing catch up, and then he did the usual trick of pulling out the bag when it counted in qualifying. But because he'd, I guess, sort of started from a lower base or was just learning the secrets of the circuit as it went, he was still learning as the race went on. And he said, like, with each lap, he was discovering a little bit more. So I think he was just sort of, it was so comfortable. And because we had a conservative tyre choice from Pirelli here, so the tyres were a lot harder. And if you didn't suffer from graining or you were able to push through the graining phase, I think the tyres basically could just be pushed and pushed and pushed. I think we saw like plus 50 lap stints from Ocon and Raikkonen, for example, during the Grand Prix. So I think Hamilton just kept learning and he was just able to push and he felt really comfortable in the car. He didn't have any alarm bells. He didn't have any need to back off. So he could just go and go and go. And this is what happens when a driver of this caliber is able to push this much. It's really, really rare. And actually, it's a good opportunity for me to plug Mark's excellent piece about the record holders after Lewis's 90-second win, because I think Mark makes a really good point in that article, which you can read on the race's website, that those kinds of wins just aren't, they're not compatible with this era, are they? With safety cars and the Pirelli tyres, you don't really see a driver crack on and build that margin. And Lewis did, and I think it was quite a fitting way for him to break Schumacher's win record.
Yeah, I'd say it was his best victory of the year. I think the thing I'd probably add to it about the reason for that difference is, yes, Valtteri's really good at picking up the grip, etc. But where we do see a difference is he's not so good when the tyres are a little bit more problematic. Lewis excels and has just a step ahead of him on that. And also, we know Valtteri's not great when he's in the turbulent air. Similar situation in the race, not with turbulent air from following, but from the kind of blustery wind. There was always a tailwind or a headwind or a crosswind. Lewis Hamilton's very, very good at adapting to that and understanding how to make the most of it. So I think that's probably why Hamilton was able to have that just extra level of pace, because he was more in tune with the varying demands of the different corners. Do you think that's a fair interpretation, Mark?
Yeah, he's better at improvising, and Valtteri is fantastic at nailing a little sweet spot of perfection and of setup and technique. And as long as everything stays the same and standard, he's very, very difficult to beat. But as soon as you have to improvise, that's where Lewis steps up. And a couple of years ago, there was the French Grand Prix at Paul Ricard, I forget which year, but it was one of those weekends where Valtteri was quicker all the way through. And then into the last session, the wind changed direction, and it was quite a blustery wind. And all of a sudden, Valtteri's well-honed technique over a particular curb and over a particular sequence of corners no longer worked. And Lewis had picked up, you know, what the implications of this wind change were. He just felt it, and he just went with it. And he was suddenly on pole by, you know, he just completely switched it around. He's on a comfortable pole. And it's that sort of improvisation that he's better at. So it took him a while to work out the code to this particular puzzle, because it was a really, really complex one. Once he did, he just stepped it up again. He was in a different league.
Yeah, and it's a great circuit for those demands, because it's so undulating. There's blind corners, you're always pointing up or down, there's cambers. He said in the press conference after the race that he was experimenting with different lines through the weekend, etc. Just all these little subtle details that that Hamilton's a master of, and yeah, so he can adapt to the wind, etc. Different people were having more trouble with that. Some were finding it a little bit easier to adapt, but just, yeah, hugely effective. Now, one thing we were missing in this race was a Red Bull challenge, which we were kind of expecting from Verstappen. He had the softs at the start, so we're thinking maybe he could get into the lead at the start. Plus, he was relatively close by 2020 standards, at least in qualifying. Obviously, just he'd been at the Nürburgring, but yeah, he was nowhere really in the end, wasn't he? He was 34 seconds behind Hamilton, and there was never really a point where you thought, yeah, Verstappen's going to be in this race. So what did you make of that, Mark? Was it just Red Bull not getting the most out of the potential, or was it just never really on to challenge Mercedes?
I think they're on the wrong tyre strategy. I think if they'd started on the mediums like Mercedes, there would have been a much closer threat. And I know Max said afterwards he didn't think it changed much, and he's right in the sense that I don't think it would have changed the result. He would have still have been third, but I think he would have been able to give them a much harder time in the first stint and would have made them work for it a bit more, and therefore would have been closer at the end. And I think, yeah, when the switch to the hards, when the Red Bull didn't like the hards as much as the medium, so he would have faded away, and which is what he said. He said, well, if I'd start on the medium, I would have just been able to follow them in the first stint, and then it would have fallen away at the end. So the end result would have been the same. And yes, the result would have been the same, but I think it would have been a more interesting, closer contest.
Yeah, it's just one of those things we keep hoping for. They're clearly making progress, but still not quite there anyway. And that means they need to be exactly on the money with everything else, with the tyre choice, et cetera, to have any hope of getting a victory. But yeah, one of those days for Max Verstappen. He's had a lot of driving around in third place, doing a good job, but there wasn't any more he could do. Now, we did see quite a bit of intrigue down the order in the midfield battle. Charles Leclerc is a really interesting one. Fourth place in the race, fourth place in qualifying. And Mark, you wrote a piece for the race website that ran on Saturday after qualifying about why Leclerc was the star of the qualifying session. You could also argue he was the star of the race as well. And that's in a race where a number of drivers, including Hamilton, were very, very impressive.
Yeah, he had a great race. But it was all upon the foundation of that lap yesterday. That was just a very special lap. Flattered the car. But also Ferrari got the tyre strategy right. They qualified him on the mediums in Q2. And you could see that he's actually able, at the switch over time, there was a period there for a few laps where you thought, oh, I wonder, Verstappen might be in reach here. He may be able to... jump Verstappen. That was purely, it wasn't because the Ferrari was as quick as the Red Bull. It's still not, but it was purely because they got the tyre strategy right. And that combined with Leclerc, I mean, he's just doing a faultless job at the moment, just punching way above the car's weight. Just giving them the result that they got, which was the absolute maximum that could have been achieved.
Yeah, he's having a brilliant season, Leclerc. A few errors aside, it's been quite wonderful. I'm sure we'll get onto Vettel in a bit. But Scott, Ferrari, you wrote a piece. We're doing a lot of plugs here. This is very good stuff. Plugs for the race website. And don't forget the hyphens. So do head there, but not until you finish listening to the podcast. You wrote a piece ahead of the weekend about how Ferrari felt they'd bottomed out and they were kind of on the recovery now. New little bits and pieces they were trying on the car. They also had a 2021 floor experiment they were running on Vettel's car during Friday practice. So do you see there's some signs of recovery for Ferrari and reasons to be vaguely optimistic?
Yeah, definitely. They've been on a steady improvement curve now for a few races. Each time they bolt upgrades onto the car, they seem to work. They're not going to achieve miracles and suddenly start fighting the Red Bull on merit, but everything's adding up. And certainly I remember sort of midway through last season, I remember, I think it was France in particular, they bought a big upgrade to Paul Ricard and were a bit baffled because it didn't quite work, which triggered a lot of, we don't have a correlation problem, but it's not working on track as well as it looks on the data, which was a weird paradox. They don't seem to have that at the moment, which is really encouraging. And I think apart from the anomalous Sochi qualifying, they've actually been getting quicker and quicker. And the good thing about here is that that race pace was there. It wasn't just star on Saturday and then sort of salvage what points you can from a good grid position on Sunday. This was a best of the rest win on merit. Leclerc was the last car on the lead lap, which is ultra impressive. And actually, not trying to say a bad thing isn't a bad thing, but I'm actually sort of quite impressed with Vettel's 10th place as well. Not in the context of, I think Seb drove a great race, but I think the fact that he was where he was relative to the Renaults and Perez and Sainz in front of him is that's actually probably Seb's most competitive run in the midfield for many, many races now. I know he sort of strategized his way into a really good result in Spain, but that wasn't really sort of, he wasn't sixth or seventh on merit there. He actually had the pace today. If he'd been, I think he could have got ahead of the Renaults, but he properly shadowed them. Whereas when he scored that point at Mugello, do you remember he was just stuck behind the Haas? I think it was Grosjean and Raikkonen. He was behind for ages, and he was obviously behind the Williams of George Russell for ages at Mugello. And here we are, three races later, and Vettel's actually sort of genuinely with those good midfield teams. So when you raise that lower bar up, Leclerc's been performing heroics all year, hasn't he? So I guess people could look at that and say, oh, it's just another good Leclerc weekend. But I think the team and the car is genuinely step-by-step improving.
And when it comes to Vettel, he said Leclerc's in a different league when it comes to dealing with the limitations of this car. We know it's not that strong at the rear. That's a bad characteristic for Vettel. You could see from watching the onboard laps, the qualifying laps, of which there are many, often people were doing several laps, two or three laps with cooldowns in between them. So lots of laps to have a look at. And you can see Leclerc's just attacking as he does on those laps, whereas Vettel's just a bit constrained with that slight hesitation in corner entry. He doesn't always get the nose in as he wants it. So it's not flowing for Vettel. And Mark, I suppose it's not a surprise this is happening. And given the limitations of the Ferrari, perhaps we can see why it's not just the fact that it's the end of Vettel at Ferrari that he's not performing well. It's the perfect storm, if you like, for things just not to go well for him.
If you had to design a car, if you had to configure a car that would show Vettel in its worst light, you'd do one with an unstable rear end. And that's what he's got with this one. And Leclerc's just much, much better able to drive around that and even exploit it, which was one of the reasons I was so enthusiastic about that qualifying lap. There were times when he's actually using that that trait to help the car's other weak spot, which is at low speed, help them get the car turned in. That, as Vettel explained it tonight in the Ferrari conference, he just said he's clearly feeling the grip of the car in a different way, and is able to go faster, and it puts him into a different range of feeling in the car. And Vettel can't even get to that threshold where you're feeling the car in that way. It's not how he's physiologically wired up, I guess. And I don't know how they would really compare if you gave them, a more neutral car, perhaps. But certainly this has shown Vettel in his least competitive possible light, yeah.
All credit to him for being quite happy to shoulder the responsibility for it and just say, yeah, Charles just driving really well, even though there have been some problems with him and the way he was dropped by Ferrari for next year, and there was some aggro earlier in the year. He's not showing it around sort of most of the people he's working with and the people who are working on the cars, etc. And he's said he's determined to finish the season on a high. I'm not quite sure where he's going to get a result from, but it'd be nice if he could have just one just strong weekend to see out the season. Now, another area where we saw plenty of change was in the battle behind Leclerc. Once the race had settled down, Leclerc's path to fourth place was quite straightforward. Fifth place was a very, very different kettle of fish. It ended up going to Pierre Gasly, just ahead of Carlos Sainz. Sergio Perez lost a few places late on. Should we start with Gasly in general? This is just another very fine performance for him. His car burnt down on Friday, basically, and he had to have a new one built up around the spare chassis. Got into Q3 as he usually does, and just had a really strong race, really made that soft stint. He went a long way on the softs and the tyres kind of came back to him a bit as well. And so he was able to, his sort of basement pace on the softs was higher than a lot of those around him. And he found more pace as he went on. Just a really classy drive from Pierre Gasly, wasn't it, Mark?
Yeah, lovely. He's doing it pretty much every time he gets in the car now, isn't he? We've seen these sort of performances from him right from the start, but initially, I mean, outside his Red Bull period, even at, you know, Toro Rosso, it wasn't every time he got in the car. It was regularly enough that you thought if he can ever connect those peaks, he's going to be a seriously impressive driver, and that's exactly what he's doing now. He's connecting the peaks, and you just know that he's going to turn in a really, really classic performance, you know, coming into any given weekend. And yeah, he did it again. He got the softs to go a long way. So probably in hindsight, the wrong tyre to start on, but he minimised the damage of that, got it a long way. And then, yeah, as he switched to the mediums, he was on the attack and did that lovely late move on Perez, after having been almost forced into the back of it the previous lap. He just did it again, got on with it, and it was a lovely drive.
And Scott, we can't talk about Gasly without the driver who his career in the past 18 months or so has been entwined with, and that's Alex Albon. 12th place he finished. Very difficult afternoon. Christian Horner, the team principal, made it very clear there's now very much a clock running against Albon, not just a stopwatch, but basically he's now got one more weekend after this one to try and justify that spot. So it's not looking great for Albon, is it?
No, it's not. I think he's probably got the Imola race really to do something special and save his drive, but I'm not really convinced that even Imola is going to be enough, to be honest. Red Bull's indicated that it does want to make the decision in the next few weeks, and Helmut Marko said before that means a decision before Turkey, and Imola is the only race between now and then. So he is almost out of time, and I think Red Bull will be really, really disappointed that they gave him this target, which is effectively an ultimatum, because it's, you know, if you don't do this, then you'll lose your drive. That's what Red Bull has said really means. And his response to that was to allow a Ferrari and a Racing Point to out-qualify him on Saturday. And then, irrespective of the difficulties that everybody had on Sunday in the opening lap or two with a lack of grip, you know, he made life needlessly difficult for himself with that first lap. The start, he'd lost two or three places by the time he was into turn one and turn two. And lost more places as the lap went on. He was just hemorrhaging time and wheel spinning in third and fourth gear, and obviously he had a lack of grip, but he was just, there's a reason that Albon lost that many places and ended up, he almost ended the second lap behind George Russell's Williams, and so he would have been 13th, I think. And there's a reason that he fell that far back while Verstappen was still inside the top four and eventually reclaimed third place and was even, you know, Harry in the Mercedes at different times. It's just, Albon was given an instruction to respond, and he capitulated. He had his second worst result of the season in terms of finishes, and he's now scored 1 point in three races since that first podium at Mugello. He's had a non-score and a 10th a non-score and a non-score, which is just, you know, it's not good enough, is it? I don't want to say it because I do think there's a driver in there, and I think he's shown proper flashes of that potential this year. But sooner or later, that just becomes potential unfulfilled. And I, at this rate, believe he will not be a Red Bull Racing driver next season.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be going that way. And the interesting question is why they don't want Gasly. And in fact, I did ask Christian Horner about this because he said earlier in the weekend that there's no alternative driver in the Red Bull stable currently. If Albon doesn't justify his place, and justify was the word he used, then they'd look outside the scheme, and that the drivers there are Nico Hülkenberg and Sergio Perez as the candidates. But Mark, what do you make of this argument that they're not interested in Gasly? Christian Horner said that, well, the stuff about he's doing a great job at AlphaTauri, I think, is redundant, because if he was the best choice in their eyes, to go in alongside Max Verstappen and solve that problem, they would plug him in, no question. I don't think AlphaTauri's situation would come into it a great deal. But Christian Horner also said, well, Albon did a better job when he replaced Gasly last year. So if we reverse that, what's to say it wouldn't be the reverse again, that Gasly would then be performing worse? And he said, well, Albon would probably be doing the same thing in an AlphaTauri, etc. But do you think they're right to rule out Gasly? And clearly, as they've done that, it's about more than just performance, isn't it?
It sounds like it, yes. I guess there's an element of one's bitten twice shy, and they don't want to look too ridiculous and having promoted the guy, demoted the guy, and then re-promoted the guy and done it the opposite, the mirror of that with Albon. There's an element of that, I guess, and how it looks. But yeah, they just continue to seem to judge that there's something in that relationship that they don't think is going to work in the senior team. And my hunch would be it'll be Hülkenberg rather than Perez. I think there's more of an affinity between Marco and Hulk than with Perez. Not that they don't get on or anything. I think it's probably just more of a cultural thing. I mean, when Christian was talking about it, he said, looking outside the junior ranks and taking on an established, experienced driver, and he used the example of like we did with Mark Webber, and I thought that was quite an interesting parallel, actually, because it would be quite a similar stature sort of driver getting his chance, wouldn't it? Highly rated, but still with not the results on the board. Giving you a big opportunity. So, yeah, I think that's probably what we're going to see. You know, in theory, Alex had these two races to sort of reprieve himself, but I think now that we've had this race, I think anything less than winning at Imola from pole isn't going to do it. Even if he's within 2 or 3 tenths of Max and finishes, you know, 10 seconds down the road and one place behind, like the sort of performance that they want from him, even if he did that in one race, I don't think that would be enough now.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I think it needs something quite special at Imola. And the problem is that, obviously, that's incredibly unlikely, but I think even the bare minimum that Mark's described there, you know, the expectation of Albon to be a couple of 3 tenths slower than Max and finish in a comfortable fourth, I don't even see him doing that, because he just doesn't, it's never coming together, is it? And if it's not coming together at conventional weekends where he has time to build up, why would that come together at a weekend where there's going to be minimal track time?
Yeah, it's a shame for Alex Albon. He's a good guy. I like the way last year when he came into Formula One, he had kind of that no fear approach, some really good drives, some good attacking drives. But it's the time's been given and it's just not coming, which is why I think this is the final throw of the dice from Red Bull. It's put the maximum pressure on, say, right, you do it over the next few weekends or it's going to change. I think you've got to just have that final go and put the pressure on, see if the kind of the cometh the hour thing comes in and Albon says, right, okay, and suddenly he's just able to get into that mindset and do it. But a shame, and it would be disastrous for his F1 career, but if you don't deliver, you're going to be under pressure. Let's talk about Carlos Sainz in sixth place. That run in the lead was fun for him. Obviously, it was never going to last. A much happier Carlos Sainz this weekend. He was struggling at the Nürburgring. He had quite a lot of new bits on the car that he was running there. I think he described the race as 60 laps of struggle or something at Nürburgring, even though he finished fifth. He had the same spec that Norris was running at the Nürburgring. They both had that, so they sort of rolled back a little bit, not because they don't think it's going to work, but because they want to understand the upgrades, the parts that complete the package, as they've said, that was started by that new nose that they're both running. But again, it just shows that Sainz is another dependable driver, isn't it, Mark? He's signed for a team that should be at the front eventually in Ferrari, and it's just another reminder that Carlos Sainz leading a Grand Prix is going to be a sight that we probably will see in a more serious way in the future.
yeah, total quality driver, has been for a long time. Always comes to the fore in these sort of conditions as well. These are sort of changeable, variable conditions. Very, very good at adapting. Very bright. And yeah, his race, the shape of his race was really determined by the tyre choice and the traits of that car, which is it's pretty quick to switch its tyres on. But if there's a circuit that tends to induce front graining, the McLaren will be among the first to find it, and that was the case here. So, yeah, he within those constraints, he did a super professional job.
Really impressed with the McLaren through turn one in general. It's really quick, that car. So a tricky corner, that one, the kind of downhill approach, quite quick. So yeah, that car is good when it's in all territory, it's pretty good. Obviously, it's quite messy in this part of the field. Sergio Perez is the logical one to talk about next, because he finished seventh. Not bad, considering he's right at the back after the first lap. But let's wind back to the first lap, Scott. The contact with Max Verstappen that spun Perez. Stewards took no action. They said, in fact, no investigation was necessary. Do you agree with that? Who was to blame or not to blame in that particular incident?
Well, it was the wrong decision, wasn't it? Because according to Otmar Szafnauer, Max went off track, came back on track, and swerved into Sergio. So it was all Max's fault, wasn't it?
That certainly seemed to be the argument from Otmar. But Otmar's having to say many things at the moment.
Yeah, it was it was very unfortunate, and Sergio was absolutely the ended up coming off as the victim, and it was such a shame that it happened that way. But how many times have we sat here now on a Sunday evening and said, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword? If you're going to try and chuck it around the outside of someone, you have to be prepared for that car to wash out. It's physics. That is what happens. And I don't think Max did anything wrong. He'd been overtaken by Bottas into turn three, and Bottas had run him out wide. But it's not like turn three immediately suddenly swings left and Verstappen had bounced off track and then bounced across into Perez. He got back on track. They rounded the left-hander at turn four. Perez tried to sweep around the outside. Max was on full lock. His car's fully loaded up. There's very little he's going to do. Even if he comes off the throttle or brakes, I don't really think the trajectory of his car is going to change that much at that point. We know how crazy little grip there was at this part of the race on the opening lap or two. So he just washed out and there was contact. It was an unfortunate first lap racing incident. No malice, I don't think, intended on Verstappen's part. Like I say, he's full lock trying to avoid it. And I think the stewards were absolutely spot on to not even investigate it. They didn't look at it and clear Verstappen. They flat out said no investigation necessary.
Yeah, I think seeing it as a racing incident, one of those things that happens, I've got no particular problem with that one. You happy with that, Mark?
Yep, spot on.
Excellent, a good concise summary. Well, Perez, that seventh place, that recovery was an important one because it kept Racing Point in third place in the Constructors' Championship. Very, very tight battle with McLaren and with Renault. We should take a diversion to the other side of the Racing Point garage. Lance Stroll, who had a pretty horrible weekend overall, ended up retiring from last place. 2 5-second penalties he had in the race, one for causing a collision with Lando Norris, one for repeatedly exceeding track limits. And this was all after the whole bafflement about his COVID-19 diagnosis that he had between the Nürburgring and here. So, Scott, can you explain the craziness of the Lance Stroll weekend?
Well, he played his part, didn't he, in Racing Point's bid for third in the Constructors' Championship, because he wiped out one of the McLarens that was on course for a load of points. So I think job done from a team point of view there. If you're not going to score points, stop the opposition from doing it. It was a really messy weekend from all of the, as you say, the confusion and murkiness around his eventual positive COVID test at the Nürburgring, or around the Nürburgring weekend, because he was actually well away from the Eiffel region and back home in Switzerland when he actually finally tested for coronavirus and tested positive. There was all sorts of controversy around this. And then he was sort of blaming that absence from the Nürburgring for his tuggy qualifying performance, where I think was he 12th on the grid, like in a car that was fifth fastest. So that was a big failure on Lance's part. The team said that he had a big snap of oversteer because of a gust of wind. I'm not sure I entirely buy that, but it's very possible. We saw it, how badly it was changing during the race itself. And then, yeah, in the Grand Prix, it was just a clumsy race. The move on Norris was never, it was on, but it was never under control. He got quite larily out of shape on the curb when he darted left, tried to pass Norris around the outside, but the attempted move was basically as soon as he got his nose in front, he just angled it for the apex. You know, where's Norris going to go? That McLaren can't disappear unless the MCL35's got a few magic tricks up its sleeve. I don't think Norris can do anything there. So it was actually, I know obviously it ruined Norris's race because Norris had to pit with damage and so did Lance, but so it was probably the fact that it had such a bad impact on Norris that led to Stroll getting a 5-second time penalty for that. But I was really pleased to see the stewards finally clamp down on someone or crack down on someone who was on the outside in one of those incidents and finally recognise that that's the trigger point, because I get quite worked up and annoyed the amount of times I see that happen, and it's always apportioned blame to the driver on the inside, and that is not how it works. So that was quite good to see. But it was just clumsy, wasn't it, all round? It was a bad race for Racing Point. Perez had that reprimand, didn't he, for swerving in front of Gasly in the closing stages, and the steward said it was just about okay fundamentally, or you know, technically as the rules are written, but it was too close to the limit, so they felt that it merited a reprimand. I don't think either Racing Point driver covered themselves in glory today.
The sad thing for Stroll was that actually, he was putting together an okay race up to that point, and he was on a trajectory that could have got him a genuinely decent result. So that made it even more unnecessary. I did ask Otmar Szafnauer if there was a kind of COVID-19 hangover, shall we say. Obviously, he's clear of it. He's tested negative before the start of the weekend. But I did wonder if maybe he was just a little bit below par. They didn't have any evidence to say that it was everything he was doing with his training and everything was normal. But maybe the most generous interpretation is to say perhaps it wasn't necessarily just the fact that he was out the car for one weekend that he was taking time to get going again. Perhaps it was just there's a slight hangover made it a bit harder for him. But even so, that doesn't really excuse the collision with Norris. That was just very, very poor judgment. And Perez, obviously the seventh place, he's tied with Esteban Ocon in terms of the way their races worked out. Ocon was eighth. He had this marathon stint on the mediums. Effectively, Perez was sort of on the same strategy. He made that early stop after the Verstappen collision and then obviously worked his way back up the order. But Ocon went further. I think he went eight laps further. We were hoping he might be able to attack on the softs after he made his stop and was shuffled back behind Gasly and Sainz, plus Perez, who'd already stopped but had been ahead of him. But then wasn't really able to go anyway, just said he couldn't get the softs working. But overall, for Ocon, a decent weekend. He beat Ricciardo on merit. That's the first time he's beaten Ricciardo in a race properly, shall we say. He finished ahead of him in the second Silverstone race, but that was only after Ricciardo had his spin. So good progress from Ocon, hasn't it, Mark? And his qualifying gaps are getting closer. So it is starting to come for Ocon. He said the communication with the team is much better as well. So after a slow start, we're starting to see hints of the Ocon we know is in there.
Yeah, he can build on that. I mean, he beat his teammate today because the medium was a better tyre to start on, and that wasn't an option open to Daniel because he'd made Q3 and Esteban hadn't. But even so, he made maximum use of that opportunity, and he made the right calls, and he did that beautiful 54 lap first stint, which was it was terrific. When he came back, you know, with just like 12 laps to go on a set of softs, the fact that he didn't really make any progress from there was just a reflection of the soft just wasn't working today. It was just wasn't the right tire, and so probably about as much as he could have done from there. So yeah, he's definitely making progress.
Yeah, and solid points all for Renault on a weekend that was their weakest for some time, to have 8th for Ocon and 9th for Ricciardo. Of course, Sebastian Vettel in 10th we talked about. Kimi Raikkonen we've touched on in 11th place. I feel a bit sorry for Raikkonen that he didn't end up with a point from this one. Obviously, it was a race of only one retirement, which was Lance Stroll, and he only retired just to save a bit of engine mileage in the end. But Raikkonen, we've talked about that first lap, but also he just drove a decent race in that Alfa Romeo. So that was one of those ones that probably merited something more for it. You were looking at Kimi's race in detail, Scott, other than the first lap. That after a couple of iffy weekends again for Raikkonen, this is back to that form we saw him on for the run of races from kind of Spain through the five or so races that followed.
Yeah, it was just a very efficient drive from Kimi. He had good pace. Ricciardo was really impressed with the performance that Alfa had. He said it wasn't easy to get past Kimi, and then had to defend a bit. Kimi put up a bit of a fight there. He battled with Vettel as well. So it was really impressive. I think that Alfa is actually, I don't think that Alfa is a bad car. I think it's now quite comfortably the leading Class C car. I think it's got a couple attempts at least on the Haas. And it looks like if it's slightly slower than the Williams in one lap form, well, it's slower than a George Russell driven Williams in one lap form, that Alfa's actually quite handy on a Sunday. And in Kimi's hands, it's just fair play to Kimi. 41 years old, he turned 41, I think, was it a week or two ago? And, you know, he was impressing everyone from Ricciardo to Albon to Verstappen and Hamilton. So, yeah, really good. Deserved a point, I think.
Yeah, just 11th place was just one of those ones that you don't get a reward. But yeah, good to see him back on form. So Albon, we talked about in 12th place, and Lando Norris ended up 13th. He carried some damage after that, so it was a bit of a nothing race in the end for him. George Russell in 14th place. Interesting driver this weekend. 7th time he was in Q2. He described this as his best all-round through the weekend performance in Formula 1. And it was a strong drive to 14th. There wasn't a great deal more he could have done, performing very well. But Scott, obviously we've got this question mark over his future. This was a bit of a saga through the weekend, wasn't it? Starting with what George Russell himself said about it on Thursday. And then perhaps you can pick up what acting team principal Simon Roberts had to say on the Friday, when he did an excellent job at not fueling speculation, apparently.
I felt bad actually on the Friday. I know it's our job. It wasn't like, you're not trying to lay a trap for them, but it's that kind of situation where you're like, well, you know, here you go. Here's a legitimate opportunity for you to give us an emphatic answer. I'm going to make the question nice and simple for you. And they don't. You know, George said that maybe Simon's comments were taken out of context. Maybe what was slightly incorrect from the interpretation of what he said is that one of the drives might be vulnerable, but maybe it's not just George's. So it has been this speculation that we know that the Perez camp has touched base with Williams and sort of sounded them out. The word inside Williams is that they haven't gone to Perez, so they haven't looked to change their driver, but they are open to it, or they're open to at least considering it. George says he's got nothing to worry about. Contract's in place next year. He hasn't been told anything that makes him concerned. Gets to Friday. And yeah, Simon Roberts, he's got the opportunity. He's basically asked to comment on the driver situation and says that they won't comment because they don't want to fuel the speculation. There's a couple of answers on that. So I just said, you don't want to fuel the speculation, but doesn't it make sense to extinguish it by confirming that the drivers will race next year and that you're not going to replace one of them with Perez? His answer was more or less, yeah, we could do that, but we're not going to. It was, which I'm, as you said, I'm going to try. We don't want to fuel the fire of speculation. So here we go. Let's go douse a bunch of petrol on it instead, as if that's something different. So that's triggered all sorts. The clear interpretation from that is that they won't confirm the two current drivers because they can't, because there is a possibility that Perez might replace one of them. Logic or common sense would dictate it's Russell because he doesn't bring multiple millions in back in like Latifi does. But the other side of that is that Perez does bring some back in and Williams does want to become a competitive force again. So actually, if you get Perez plus 8 million once Perez's salary is taken into consideration. How much can you buy out Latifi for? Maybe he's the one that goes, but it's not that clear cut. Toto Wolff and Mercedes are adamant that Russell's situation isn't bad. It doesn't look bad at all. They're not even considering a plan B for him, apparently. And now Russell's come out and said that he thinks that this has all just been planted by the Perez camp because they want to push Red Bull into a decision. If that's the case, I would expect a man of Julian Jacobi's experience to know that trying to force Red Bull's hand with the prospect of Perez signing for Williams is a bluff that Red Bull are probably more than happy to call. So I can absolutely imagine it being part of the fun and games. So I don't see it turning into, I don't see that being what forces Red Bull's hand, let's put it that way. So I'd be interested to see how it goes, because Latifi will have obviously a very good claim for one of the seats, but Russell and Mercedes seem quite happy with the claim that George has to his. So maybe nothing will change after all this, and it will all have just been a bit of fun for nothing.
Yeah, it seems like there's a serious possibility there, and the team would be right to look at Perez, given he's a high-quality driver who can bring money, and they can get him for a long-term deal as well, which they can't currently on George Russell. Whether that changes, I don't know. If it was a question of long-term George Russell versus long-term Perez, a little bit different than this one, because currently, obviously, Russell is resoundingly a Mercedes driver. But yeah, interesting to see how that one pans out. And yeah, anything is possible in the driver market, isn't it? That's just the way things go. But what this weekend reminded everyone is how much they'd lose. I see quite a lot of people not quite getting how good Russell has been. I saw some amusing. We had some comments on some of our stories saying, "Oh well, Russell, he's behind Latifi in the championship this year." Well, here's a fact for you. Fernando Alonso at Minardi finished behind Tarso Marquez, who was his teammate for most of the season. Does that mean Tarso Marquez is better and Fernando Alonso is rubbish? Of course it doesn't. That's just a capricious fact of if you're at the back and you get countbacks and that kind of thing, this happened.
I saw someone say that, you know, maybe George Russell should think about scoring a point in Formula One before he has, you know, ideas on getting a Mercedes seat. I was like, I'm not entirely sure that him not scoring a point in Formula One so far is really his doing.
Yeah, exactly. He's hauling that Williams into Q2 seven times. It's ridiculous. Latifi has done it once, but he's the best qualifier of that group at the back, and there's some quick drivers there. And we should actually tick some of them off as well. Giovinazzi was 15th place, not much to say about him other than the fact he did have some contact with Sebastian Vettel on the first lap, but after a couple of decent runs, he was behind Raikkonen again this weekend. Roman Grosjean and Kevin Magnussen, 16th and 17th, obviously both axed by Haas for next year. We talked about that in our Thursday podcast episode that myself and Mark Hughes talked in depth about them. But Romain Grosjean did give away an interesting fact about that car, that they've got problems with the rear suspension overheating. Some components there, and as they get hotter, the ride height changes, and it's leading to a lot of inconsistency. It's one of these reasons why sometimes at the end of FP3, they're very happy with the car. Then, of course, the suspension cools down, and then it warms up again when you start to run it. So 4.4% aero balance shift is the range that Romain Grosjean says it can cause, which is pretty huge. There's a piece on the race website that ran on Sunday morning with Gary Anderson giving his analysis of that, which is well worth taking a look at. Magnussen has the same problem, but to a lesser extent. So that's just adding to the problems that the Haas has got. And Grosjean was saying, well, we've got the slowest car in the Haas. There's not much they can do about it. Nicholas Latifi finished 18th. One of those weekends for him, he set a faster time in qualifying, got it deleted for exceeding track limits, and then, you know, did what he could do with an unpromising car, but did finish ahead of Daniel Kvyat, who had one of those races to 19th place. Not a great one for him. He dropped to last on the first lap and never really recovered. We've got to, in this podcast, finish off just by talking about the win record properly that Hamilton has got. I don't want us to go over ground that we did last week when Hamilton equaled the Michael Schumacher record. But I think it is worth just having a moment just to think 92 World Championship Grand Prix victories, Mark. It is preposterous, really, isn't it? What an achievement.
Yeah, fantastic achievement. And as ever, for some bizarre reason, some people are looking to belittle it because he's in the best car. But, you know, of all, I think, we talked about that feature before of the seven drivers that have held this record in the history of the championship. They've all been in the best car. They've all been in either a very good or an outstanding car throughout their careers. And that's, but there's a reason why they get into those cars. It's because they're outstanding drivers. And yeah, he's just, I mean, the multifaceted level of his skill is now, you know, really shoring up his claim to be one of the all-time greats, because it's not just a very fast driver in the best car. It's way more than that, and he's shown that in so many different ways just in this season alone. And today was one of those, working out the puzzle of what was required with the tyres, and it was a puzzle that very few others succeeded in working out. And that's, you know, he's the full package, and he's worked extremely hard for the last 3 or 4 years in eliminating any previous weaknesses in his game, and he fully deserves everything he's got, and fully deserves full recognition.
Absolutely, it's rather joyless, I think, to kind of belittle it as you said. Like today, yeah, Lewis Hamilton wins Grand Prix is a bit of a boring story for people. I can understand why people don't like that aspect of it, but you can find it predictable and repetitive, but at the same time appreciate and understand and celebrate it in that way. I'm not necessarily saying that this is what it should always be, and it's great that it's predictable, but you can separate that, the fact you might not enjoy it, from the fact you can appreciate it. I think that's important.
Yeah, I think races like today are the ones where people watching now, especially people who don't give Hamilton the credit he deserves, they look at races like today and they don't see what's special about them. They see them as an example of Hamilton having no competition and being able to dominate, and it comes easy for him. But in 5, 10, 15 years time, when people are looking back at how Hamilton achieved what he achieved, this will be just one of however many races he ends up on in terms of victories, but it will also be an example. It will be a footnote in a feature. It will be something that someone at some point looks back on and says, you remember when Hamilton was able to just graft those victories, those weekends where he was behind Bottas, but he managed to pull another pole out of the bag and he managed to win by this much or whatever. You know, these are all little puzzle pieces in what is going to eventually be an incredible, incredible picture, really rich in detail. And it's going to be beautiful to stand back and look at some point. And I understand why people don't want to do it now, but wouldn't it just be so much more enjoyable if you could just appreciate what you're seeing while it's happening? Because it's history in the making, and it's the sort of thing that I am in however many years' time. Like, I will look back on and be grateful that I've been able to see it, because this is the kind of narrative that happens so very rarely. So to actually be around for it, I think, is something not to be sniffed at. And actually, while we're on the subject of people who are absolutely mega and achieving crazy things, while we're recording this, Scott Dixon's just won what I think is his sixth IndyCar title or something crazy like that. So it's a good day if you're one of the greatest to ever take part in your respective championship.
I think this is 1,730th IndyCar title. He's quite some driver, Scott Dixon. But yeah, what Lewis Hamilton is doing, the challenges of different eras vary. There's been lots of talk about that over recent times. But they do vary. The way you have to win, the things you have to factor in, it's the same thing from a distance, but when you look in detail, the challenges are very different. But what Hamilton's doing and putting it all together for the time, it's the same thing Michael Schumacher did in his time, Ayrton Senna did, Alain Prost did, Niki Lauda, Jackie Stewart, Juan Manuel Fangio, Jim Clark. I'm trying to avoid missing anyone out now, but you know, all of that kind of elite group of drivers in history, the absolute all-time greats, have always mastered the challenge in front of them. And Lewis Hamilton has done that. The fact he's got more wins doesn't in itself mean that he's better than any of those. But what they all share is that amazing achievement. And there's only a few drivers who are in that conversation for the greatest of all time. You can never resolve it, but Hamilton is absolutely one of them and has a very, very strong case to be made. And who knows how many wins he's going to end up on. I'd be amazed if he doesn't past the 100 mark. He's going to get seventh world championship and probably the eighth. So yeah, there's going to be lots more chance to appreciate what he's doing. Well, thanks very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes, for your insight. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen to read those many dozens of features that we've plugged and plenty of others that we also haven't. If you enjoyed this podcast and you haven't already, do subscribe or even give us a review on your podcast supplier of choice if you feel so inclined. Check out some of our other podcasts, including Bring Back V10s, the Gary Anderson F1 show, and also check out our YouTube channel. Just search for The Race. Loads of interesting videos to watch there. We'll be back next week with all of the insight from the I've forgotten what the race is called. Imola. San Marino Grand Prix. Let's call it the San Marino Grand Prix. It's the region, isn't it? The
Emilia Romana.
Emilia Romana, yeah. Yeah, so I've done very well there. So I'm going to call
it Emiliana Romana. Something Romana.
Well, it's very.
I'm getting less confident as I say it.
Should we just call it the San Marino Grand Prix? It wasn't in San Marino.
The Eiffel Rennen.
Yeah, call it the Eiffel. It wasn't the San Marino Grand Prix when it was called the San Marino Grand Prix because it wasn't in San Marino. It's no closer to San Marino. So, you know, let's just go with history on that.
This is its third. This is third Grand Prix title.
Of course,
because
Italian.
It was originally the Italian Grand Prix.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, held once. So yeah. We'll get into the semantics of the race, and I'll actually learn what it's properly called in time for next week's podcast, maybe. But yeah, join us next week for everything you need to know from Imola.